Hello, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast.
Yes, we're two really awesome people who've done lots of stuff before talk about books and movies from a Catholic worldview.
Hey, I like that very much.
Okay. Yeah, doesn't that sound good?
That sounds perfect.
I can only say that because that was the very nice tribute paid by Luke and Jesse and Tamahome on the, let's see, SFBRP, it's Science Fiction Book Review Podcast, our podcast.
That was fantastic.
Yeah,
it was really nice to hear.
I know. They were having a podcast, science fiction podcast review episode, where they were talking about some podcasts we might not have heard that they like. And they were saying, and I really like Luke's podcast. He reviews science fiction books in depth.
Mm-hmm. And I like it too. So yeah, check that out for sure. If you like science fiction books, that's a great way to get some reviews.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, and the crazy thing was they were saying, there's no one out here like you. And he goes, well, there is one. And I was like, could it be? Is he going to say? And he said it. A good story. It's hard to find.
Yeah, that was neat.
So that was pretty neat. And they were really very complimentary, very nice. And so that was made my Monday morning to listen to it. So, but we probably won't change the beginning. They were saying that they thought we were being too narrow and just saying that we were Catholics. But of course, as the Catholics out there know, we're talking about Catholic stuff specifically, so that's kind of important to how it's defined.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. Yep.
We could say two really awesome Catholics.
Yeah, awesome should be in there somewhere, huh?
Yeah. Well, I think this actually kind of ties into the book because there's a distinct lack of humility shown by a lot of the people in it.
For certain. And the book we're talking about is And Then There Were None by Agatha Christie. And this is episode 17, by the way.
Oh, good to remember that.
Yes.
You're on top of your game.
Yep. Wow. Okay. So, yeah, 17. Can you imagine?
I know. Well, because we've been doing this since January.
Yeah, we started it at the beginning of January.
Yeah.
And it's just as fun now as it was then.
Oh, yeah. I know. Isn't that great?
You bet.
I love it.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is a classic murder mystery, so classic that most people have heard of it if they haven't read it, or they've seen a movie or maybe a play of it. Even my husband, who doesn't ever read murder mysteries, said, I know that one. Aren't there people on an island? And I was like, yep. But if you haven't read it, it is amazingly constructed. And essentially the story is that we start off seeing all these different people from their point of view, trains, cars, however they're getting there, they've all been invited to an island for vacation. Mm-hmm. And there have been a lot of rumors about the island, who's bought it, what's being done to get it ready for exotic guests. So they're all pretty interested in it. And the interesting thing, if you're reading, is you notice that all the letters have been sent by different people. They all kind of reread their letters or think about who sent them, and you start noticing it's not the same name or the same purpose stated. Like, you know, we're having a big party, and one of them is, I need a secretary, and that kind of thing. So they all meet each other, and they start to go, wow, you're not at all what I expected for this gathering.
Yeah. Yeah, there's one scene where they're waiting for the boat to take them over, and he says, all right, who's going to this island? And four people say, we are. And they all look at each other like, what?
You too.
Yeah, you, why are you going to there? You know?
Yeah, what's up with this? Yeah. And so when they get to the island, they're all starting to, you know, have dinner and get to talk to each other and kind of that comfortable chit chat of, you know, who are you and where do you come from? And after dinner, suddenly a record starts playing. Oops, I gave that away. Spoiler, sorry. A voice suddenly thunders out.
Oh, that's not really a spoiler.
Okay, good. Because they don't know where the voice came from.
Right, initially. But they do within moments.
Yes. And says, "You have all been accused of these crimes."
Yep.
And starts reading the names with what they're accused of, and it's murder, always.
Right, right. So it goes through the list of 10 names, and each one of them, it says, is guilty of a murder themselves. Yep.
Yeah, there's no suspected of, guilty of. That's it.
Guilty.
Yes.
So, of course, you know, all of these people, you know, try and figure out what happened. You know, they discover that it was a record, and there's a servant there who has never met his boss.
Yeah, that's right. I forgot.
Yeah, and they question him, you know, what's going on here? And then they start to realize that nobody knows who invited him to this island.
Yeah. And that the names were all different.
Mm-hmm.
And then one person has a drink, because they're all busy protesting and saying, well, I didn't do this, or this was legit. They're all protesting, except for one person, what they're accused of. And one person takes a drink and suddenly starts kind of swallowed wrong, choking. No, he falls down dead.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
I'm not sure what point spoilers start.
And let the suspicions begin. You can imagine, you know, from the bird's eye view of the book, you have these people, 10 of them, and they start to be murdered one by one. And the people that are left get more and more nervous, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And they snipe at each other and accuse each other. Everyone's looking at each other and with suspicion, trying to figure out who the murderer is.
And they're all trying to... They're all trying to figure that out, and they're also trying to get off the island, but nothing they do can get any attention from the mainland. So they figure that's all been set up. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the interesting things about this book is we have a couple of characters who we feel more sympathetic to than the others, but the book lets you inside of almost everybody's mind.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see really inside of the servant's head, the servant and his main servant and his wife who act as the butler and the cook. But most of the other main characters you'll start seeing what they're thinking.
Yeah.
You know, so you start to see, were they guilty of what they were accused of? How did they look at what they're being accused of and how they're presenting it? Also, what their suspicions are. And a lot of times those suspicions are very well logically worked out. Mm-hmm. So you're like, oh, that must be right. I thought it could have been this person. So the whole time you're guessing along with that person because there's so many possibilities that all could be true.
Right. And what we talked briefly right before the podcast about how if there's any book that you don't want to spoil for somebody, it's this one.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll go into spoiler territory here in a little bit, because the thing, it's very intricate and, really, I was so impressed by it, reading it. I told you that I was in the play and, I was, Justice Lawrence Wargrave.
Ooh.
Yes. Mr. Owen is one of us. Yeah. That kind of stuff. So, but it's great fun to be in those, but the whole book. So I knew, I guess I knew who the killer was because I'd been in this play.
Right.
And so when I read this novel, I knew who it was going to be. So even knowing who it's going to be and reading the novel was super interesting because, it is subtle. It is so subtle. And it's like a giant puzzle, and it fits together, and there's only one way it fits together. And the book has differences from the play, too, and we'll need to talk about that once we get into spoiler territory as well.
Yeah, and if you have seen only the movie or the play, which has differences, I would really suggest that you read the book, because I've never really been able to enjoy one of the movies or make it all the way through, because I already had my mental images so set that the people they would pick wouldn't really, to me, reflect them properly. So I've always had that trouble with Agatha Christie, though. They never pick a Miss Marple who looks to me like the right Miss Marple. Hercule Poirot.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Murder on the Orient Express is one that I've seen. And I forget who played, isn't Poirot in that one?
Yeah, that's Hercule Poirot. And, oh gosh, that was a famous actor or more prominent actor of the time who did him. And he actually was an okay Poirot, but I guess for me, the movies, you know how it is. If a book's taken, a movie's taken from a book, it's never as satisfying as the book itself. So I was always like, I really don't care how they portray this. I tend to do that with books and movies. I mean, Pride and Prejudice, I don't really care if I see the movie ever. I've read the book 1,000 times.
Right, right.
So that's my
If you ever do watch that, the long version with Jennifer Ely, E-H-L-E. That's really good stuff. Yeah. It's a PBS, no, I'm sorry, Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, okay, sorry.
Yeah. There's a 6-hour version. I don't know. I think it's BBC, not PBS, but
it's on PBS.
Miniseries and it's terrific.
Yeah, and I hear there's, just to really digress, I hear there's a new Jane Eyre that, you know, that 2011 Jane Eyre that was done earlier this year. I hear it's fantastic.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that's another one where I just go, I just don't care. But that one, so much praise was heaped on it. I was kind of interested in seeing it.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we don't see many Agatha Christie movies nowadays. I wonder why.
In the 70s, there was a big spate of them, I think. Uh-huh. And I guess she's gone out of favor.
I guess so, but I'm not sure why.
She died in the mid 70s, maybe, or late 70s. And I remember she would come out with 2 books a year, Christmas and middle of the summer. And my parents the new Agatha Christie's coming out in a couple of weeks. And it wasn't like now where now there will be the hardback and the big paperback. It was just a regular paperback. And I saw it at the grocery store, so I picked it up and it would go through the household. So I grew up reading the last of them, and my parents had most of our other books, so I would read them.
Oh, neat.
And they're very simply written and very accessible for, I think I started reading them in the 4th grade. I read Death Comes as the End, which, if you haven't read it, is also wonderful to try and figure out who did it, and she set that in ancient Egypt.
Ah.
It's the only one of her books that's set in a different time like that.
I see. Yeah, I haven't read too many. I was in 10 Little Indians, and then I directed The Mousetrap, which I don't know if it's a book or not. Yeah, yeah, okay, it's a short story.
It's a short story or a novella.
It's one of the most famous plays out there. When we were doing it, I looked on Wikipedia, and I remember it said something like, this is one of the longest-running plays ever in England.
And yeah,
somewhere
it's
still running.
Because in her autobiography, which I highly recommend, and I actually read a couple little bits of at Forgotten Classics, and I'll find where that was for Lenyap, but she said that she gave the rights to that to her grandson, Matthew. And she said, well, we could have known it was going to have the longest run of anything because he's always been the luckiest one in the family. She says he can live off of that.
Wow.
So, but if you ever want a good look at Victorian England and growing up in those times in a poor but well-off enough family to have servants and things. That's a wonderful book to read. Very entertainingly written about everything then.
Oh, neat.
Just FYI.
Okay. Good to know. Good to know.
Yeah. But yeah, her books are, you know, of course, she wrote so many, 50 or 60?
Yeah.
She started it as a hobby, as one of those, you know, girls in Victorian, you know, teenagers, young women during World War I. And a little before that, she was kind of bored. So her mother said, well, here, write a book. Okay. And so the book that she wrote turned into The Mysterious Affair at Stiles, which was her first book.
Wow, I've heard of that.
Still famous. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And so, and then she just kind of went on from there, writing book after book. And as I say, some are better than others. And I tend to like Miss Marple's character, her two regular detectives were Miss Marple and Hercule Poirot, the retired Belgian investigator. But then she'd have others like this, which were just standalone.
Yeah.
So That's a short history of the author.
Nice.
No one has to look her up that much.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and her writing style, you know, I say it's intricate, but the writing style is so simple.
Yes.
Easy to fly through. But yet it's just these, her chapters in this book, I don't know if this is standard for her, but mm-hmm. are very, very small. So mm-hmm. she would flip from character to character, the point of view of all these characters. And it's just, like I said, it's just so intricately put together. It's well worth reading just for that, just to see how she did that. And then the mystery itself is just, it's challenging. I didn't get to read this without knowing who the murderer was, but if, mm-hmm. if you can, read it without knowing who the murderer is, and then it'd be really interesting to see how many people figure it out.
Oh yeah, because I know I didn't. I was flabbergasted, and when I first read it, and then the interesting thing was, you know what? I think we have to talk about spoilers.
Okay, I'm ready at any time.
Spoilers.
All right, this is the point at which you will know who did it.
Yeah.
So if you don't want to know that, please go read the book because it's so worth it. Go do it.
I know. Well, and I do want to say I was super excited to see that Jeff Miller, the Kurt Jester, actually mm-hmm. read this book. I saw it on Goodreads a week or two ago.
Oh, yeah, I did. I saw that post.
And
too,
I said, oh, I didn't know you hadn't read it. And he said, well, I saw you were going to podcast it, so I wanted to get ready. And I was like, oh, I am really complimented now. So.
Yeah, that's neat.
Yes, that no great. Humility around here. but, okay, so here's what I knew was that, okay, since we're in spoiler territory, I knew that the judge did it, and I knew the stratagem he used, and I remembered that Dr. Armstrong helped him, but I could not remember the point from which he helped. If he was more of a full accomplice, if he was also fooled,
mm-hmm.
because it had been a long time since I read this, and it is so simply written, and I'd read it so many times before that I could remember a lot of it. It was very familiar to me. But it was toward the end of the book when I finally went, he couldn't have told him very far ahead, or he would have known he was doing all those murders. But even that, she kept me guessing because the clues are all there, but they're very subtle. She was accused a lot of the time of just suddenly dropping in, oh, clue, 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 bam. You mm-hmm. know, here now I'll tell you these things. But if you reread her books, those clues were always there. She just would just hint at them, really.
I recall that there was a criticism of the mousetrap mm-hmm. that so many people found that unfair. But when you go through a play so many times, you know, through rehearsal after rehearsal after rehearsal, you realize that there's always comes to a point when I'm doing a play that I understand everything. There's like this tipping point at which, mm-hmm. you know, during rehearsal, now, oh, everything comes clear and you can see what the author was doing the entire time.
Mm-hmm.
And even in The Mousetrap, which had a lot of this criticism about, hey, she just pulled that out and there is no way.
you know, we couldn't have guessed.
If you look at that script, that's the only way, you know?
Yeah.
So, with this one, I think it was, you know, reading it, knowing who the killer was, mm-hmm. you know, I can see exactly that she was doing it, but I don't know that I know the book well enough to say there was no other possibility. You know, I think people would read this book and come away with thinking, I don't think any of them did it. You know, how did, you know, that's what I think that a person would think, but maybe I'm incorrect.
Yeah. And the point that had somehow eluded me in reading it all those times before, I think, cause I was, you know, I was a kid. And then knew it pretty well, so I wasn't paying attention, was the fact that he kind of cheated in order to get his 10 little Indians, you know, because mm-hmm. the guy who set everything up on the island had to be killed also. And to achieve the full 10,
mm-hmm.
since he essentially executed himself for that murder.
Right.
But but the thing that I also saw going through this time, because I was reading it for the podcast and I was going, oh my gosh, I picked it because it's a light summer read. It's a mystery. It's fairly short. Sorry, Scott.
No.
Not that I haven't picked heavy books too, but I was like, I need something easy.
Heck yeah.
But I was thinking about murder and guilt and repentance. And of course, these are very Catholic themes traditionally. But what I noticed this time from the very beginning is that when you're looking inside everybody's minds, they're busy denying what they did, justifying themselves, and being so selfish most of the time.
Yes.
If they're not selfish, then they're like, was that the general who kind of did the David and Uriah thing where he sent his wife's young wife's lover off to the war to be killed? And he pretty much went, yeah. And he just was full of regret for what he'd done and what he'd lost. But like Vera, who the people are killed in order of what the judge assesses to be their level of guilt and complicity in evil in deciding to do this. So Vera is one of the last ones because she murdered a child in order to get her lover, who was his, what, nephew or something? It was one of those family things where the kid was going to inherit the money, and if he died, Hugo, her boyfriend essentially, would inherit all the money. And so she just made sure that happened, and the boyfriend knew it, and he would never talk to her again. And she was like, at the very beginning, she's thinking, Hugo, I won't think of him, but he said he loved me. And I'm reading this thinking, do you realize what you did? And all you're doing is going, he said he loved me, and then he wouldn't talk to me anymore. And I'm like, oh my gosh, you have no moral compass at all.
Yeah.
It's all about you.
And it's interesting in Wargrave's explanation, he's saying, you know, he really, really, really wanted to murder somebody himself after being on the bench all this time.
Yeah.
He really, really wanted to do it, but he had this sense of justice. So he was finding over, you know, it took him a long time to come up with this list of 10 people who he felt, well, he basically declared guilty and was going to perform this justice himself. And that's how he justified the whole murder thing to himself.
Well, yeah, because he was obviously a tightly controlled psychopath, because he said from the time he was young, he'd been fascinated by murder and the idea of doing it. But he had this sense of justice that wouldn't let him do it. So he wound up on the bench being a judge. And he also was saying that he went to a lot of trouble to verify as much as he could that everybody had done what they said.
Yeah.
And it turns out everybody actually was guilty. But the lesser ones, like the Anthony Marston, who died first, he didn't even remember the names when they said, you killed so-and-so and so-and-so. And he goes, huh, well, that must have been those two kids who I ran down that time in Cornwall or whatever. Yeah. You're just like, oh my gosh, you didn't even, that didn't bring anything to mind. You have to stop and think about it. So he was completely amoral. And Mrs. Rogers, who was the butler's wife, she had been obviously pressured into it by her husband, or it certainly seemed like she was under his thumb. And so she went next, maybe. But so he was trying to dispense merciful killings at the same time.
Right, but, and along with that poem as well. That's another aspect.
Yeah,
that's that, you know, the he took the time to, you know, the nursery rhyme. And nursery rhymes, man, those things are rough.
Ten Little Indians. Well, I know, because it was first called Ten Little Niggers, right?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
I'm sorry, and we're talking about an old poem, and this book was written in 1939 under the title Ten Little Niggers, and later it was changed in 1940.
Right,
yeah. Because, of course, it was quite insensitive. So they changed it to And Then There Were None, which actually works better
anyway. It does, yeah, it really does.
But yeah, that's... Do you want me to read it? I have it.
Oh, go right ahead if you'd
like. Okay, it says... This isn't the original version, so because they changed it later to be 10 Little Soldiers instead of 10 Little Indians. So 10 little soldier boys went out to dine. One choked his little self, and then there were nine. Nine little soldier boys sat up very late. One overslept himself, and then there were eight. Eight little soldier boys traveling in Devon. One said he'd stay there, and then there were seven. Seven little soldier boys chopping up sticks. One chopped himself in halves, and then there were six. Six little soldier boys playing with a hive. A bumblebee stung one, and then there were five. Five little soldier boys going in for law. One got in chancery, and then there were four. Four little soldier boys going out to sea. A red herring swallowed one, and then there were three. Three little soldier boys walking in the zoo. A big bear hugged one, and then there were two. Two little soldier boys sitting in the sun. One got frizzled up, and then there was one. One little soldier boy left all alone. He went out and hanged himself, and then there were none.
Hmm. Wow.
So gruesome.
Yeah, it really is.
And everybody's like, oh, yes, that old nursery rhyme. How I loved it. You know, and you're just like, oh, really? Well, kids don't have that same sense of reality that adults apply to stuff anyway.
Uh-huh. Right, right.
Think about it.
Yeah, one of the aspects to me that worked so well in this book is, you know, you have these 10 people all guilty, and they're being offed one by one.
Mm-hmm.
And they are cut off from civilization. And mm-hmm. with each murder, they become more frantic.
Yeah.
Their basic it's not unlike a zombie story, is it?
Because thank goodness, I was wondering when we could get zombies in here. Good job, Scott.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. It's been several episodes.
Yes.
But you know, you're dealing with, you know, the zombie stories. Normally you have the cutting off of civilization, you know, mm-hmm. civilization is shut off when the apocalypse happens.
Right.
And, here you've got a microcosm or like a Lord of the Flies type of a situation almost.
Mm-hmm.
So they're becoming less and less,
human.
Yeah, less and less human, less and less high thinking, I guess is what I was
or
trying
civilized.
To say.
Civilized. Yeah.
Or civilized would be, I guess, another word for it, but.
But high thinking, yeah.
Yeah, so they're not using their faculties. but there's yeah. one point at which, I think it was Vera, I'm just calling this up here.
Yeah.
It's close to the end. Yeah, Vera cried, don't right. you see? We're the zoo. Last night yeah. we were hardly human anymore. We're the zoo.
Mm-hmm.
And so what do you think she's calling human? The human, you know, I think, you know, everyone's accusing each other. Everyone's selfish. Everyone's trying to survive. So everyone's going to their baser instincts. And basically, you know, the instinct for survival becomes the most prevalent reason for action. And
well,
I think
and
that's what she's
maybe,
saying.
Yeah, that and the lack of holding back and thinking about the other people.
Mm-hmm.
I think right. it would also be that more animal versus mm-hmm. human
yeah.
aspect. Right. And Agatha Christie, she didn't really, she never preached or anything, but she kind of had a strong sense of that when you're reading all her books, her sense of what's due to human beings, every single human being is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes you'll see a murderer who, well, like Philip Lombard, who his crime, he's one of the ones who lasts till the end. And his crime was that he abandoned 20 African natives to die
uh-huh.
and got himself out of whatever situation it was. I can't remember if they said. And he was very, well, yeah, sure, I did it. Well, they're just natives. They don't feel it the way we do, you know.
Yeah,
and,
that was a shocking
wasn't
line.
It?
Yeah.
And everybody
I don't think I highlighted it, but it was a shocking line. He said something like, they don't feel about death the same way we
right.
do. It's like they're okay to die, you know.
Well, and that's kind of that's that animal zoo-like lack of consideration for anyone else. And that's, mm-hmm. he just, to me, highlighted it. That and Vera talking about, oh, Hugo, I thought you loved me. I'm just like, oh, completely self-centered.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Rogers are guilty of killing the old lady that they took care of
mm-hmm.
by not giving her heart medicine when she should have had it so they would inherit. And you know, that's a crime that these days some people might think of as, well, that's merciful. Poor old thing, she was suffering. That's yeah. looked at people, a lot of people wouldn't even think that was a bad thing these days. Mm-hmm. They would all think that abandoning the natives was bad.
Right, right.
Or killing the child
mm-hmm.
because the child was not, you know, the child was old enough to talk and swim and everything.
Mm-hmm.
But it's kind of funny that I just thought of that how outlooks have shifted
Yeah, yeah.
Because those would all be reprehensible crimes back in the day.
Yeah. That's true. That's, yeah. It's hard to think
and,
about.
Yeah. Mm. And they might make excuses for somebody like Anthony Marsden who, well, he doesn't really understand what he's doing. Let's give him a lot of, we'll shut him up and give him some therapy. But the judge isn't going to go for that.
Right.
Well, and I think, but you're right, that being in the zoo, it's me first.
Yeah, it's me first. And then she's also assuming that someone is watching him because a zoo requires someone to observe as well.
And actually, somebody is watching them, but they don't know it.
Right. Well, they assume that someone's killing them. So they know that somebody is around. They just, you know, they have no idea if it's somebody they haven't discovered yet or if it's one of them.
I thought by that time they'd figured
well,
it was
them. They probably did. But in my mind, you know, reading the book,
yeah,
I would have to always assume that surely there's someone else out there. That's one of the intricate pieces. Yeah, and I'd love to talk about the end. Because the way that it ends is, it's magnificent because...
Yes, it is because you think, oh my God, what? We don't know who did it because yeah. Look, this person couldn't have been killed then. This person couldn't have been killed then.
Right, right.
And she's showing off basically how intricate it is and how clever it is.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was.
It was amazing. So it differs from the play. So this was a revelation to me. So okay. What happens is there ends up being three people. Mm-hmm. I believe it was Bloor, Lombard, and Vera Claythorne, right?
Right.
So
yeah, that was the ending was amazing.
Yeah. So Bloor gets killed.
Yeah.
With a clock falls on his head.
Yes.
And then Vera kills Philip, and it's the first murder that happens in the book in which you see the killer. So Vera kills Philip with a gun because she knows that he did it because they're the only two left. She knows that he's
almost it's almost written like a movie.
Uh-huh.
Because it's they find because they think that's why they think there's somebody else. They hadn't found Armstrong's body, and he'd been killed earlier. But
oh, that's
they
right.
Assume
he's
hiding.
No. They did find him because because they pulled him up to.
But I'm looking at the book, and they found Bloor dead, and they say, "Well, look, there's some old clothes down there."
Oh, okay. So they find Bloor dead,
go,
and then they
wait,
find
that's
Armstrong.
Not
okay.
Clothes. It's a man. The man was wedged in between two rocks, flung there by the tide earlier in the day.
Mm-hmm.
Lombard and Vera reached it in a last scramble. They bent down. A purple, discolored face. A hideous, drowned face. Lombard said, "My God, it's Armstrong."
Mm-hmm.
Eons passed. Worlds span and world. Time was motionless. It stood still. It passed through 1,000 ages. No, it was only a minute or two. Two people were standing looking down on a dead man. Slowly, very slowly, Vera Claythorne and Philip Lombard lifted their heads and looked into each other's eyes. I was like, wow, that's like a movie.
Yeah, it sure is. Yeah.
And that's when you, the reader, are going, oh my gosh, I like both of them. She's made them
happened?
Both likable.
Right.
And this is when the zoo happens because the outer skin comes off and we see exactly who these people are.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So
go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, no, that's fantastic. Okay. So then, yeah, Vera does kill Philip. And then Vera.
She had a dinner.
Vera, yeah. And Vera feels, I mean, her guilt by now is overflowing. You know, she killed Philip and she's probably not certain that he did it. But it's still, and her guilt from what she did before has been brought up to the forefront as well. So she's got a very heavy burden of guilt. And then she goes to her room and there's a noose hanging there already. Mm-hmm. And she goes ahead and she hangs herself.
She's almost in a trance state. She's so relieved. It's, oh, I don't have to be afraid of the house. But she just, Hugo's up there. Cause yeah, she's been haunted the whole time by what she did and her love for Hugo, who, you know, wouldn't respond after the death of his nephew.
Mm-hmm.
And, it was the oddest thing.
And then there you go. Now you've got They're dead. 10 people are dead at this point in the book.
And you're left going, what?
So, yeah, I mean, what kind of conclusion can you be left with other than there's got to be somebody else? There's got to be somebody else on there. And now the book doesn't end there.
Yeah.
The book, the next chapter, is from the point of view of two police officers who are discussing the case because the, you know, time has passed and the house has been discovered and it's been investigated and they're looking into it. And they're flabbergasted, of course. They have no idea what the heck happened.
Yeah, they kind of break it all down.
They break the whole thing down for you and they say, yeah, well. And they're flummoxed, and they have no idea who did it.
Yeah.
And then the very last chapter of the book, and this was just terrific. I was blown away by it. I was riveted.
Oh, well, and plus, I'm thinking it's clever because you have the last chapter where you're like, what? And then there's the epilogue.
Yeah, epilogue. That's
so,
what it was. Yep.
And then at the end of the epilogue is, well, in that case, who killed them? And you're like, what again? It's like cliffhanger. Uh-huh. And then there's the manuscript document sent to Scotland Yard by the master of the Emma Jane fishing trawler.
Yeah. And it's so it's
the final thing.
Right. And it turns out that one of the 10, well, we've already said who it is, but one of the 10 put a note in a bottle and threw it into the ocean and it explained the whole thing.
Yeah.
And wow. I mean, that letter
was
great.
Not to have everybody know, a chance for everyone to know his cleverness.
Yeah, and he says that in the letter.
He's very self-aware.
He is very self-aware. So, yeah, he says, this is pretty cool, and I'm going to tell you how I did it.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and
yeah,
why,
I guess,
and why, too.
Yeah, well, and I guess everybody else's crimes were essentially crimes of passion, whether they were planned or not planned. They were all spur of the moment in that sense, as opposed to his, which was carefully planned for a long time, very deliberately.
Mm-hmm.
So, he was the highest thinking psychopathic killer.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is, when I read the book, I was like, well, these people all deserve to die.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, being a high school kid and not religious at all for any reason.
Right, right.
And you're kind of set up with they did bad things and they got away with them. Shouldn't there be some kind of justice? But she doesn't give us that in the end, even though that's how it's presented all the way through. Because what you do is when you see under the judge's skin, he's horrible. He's like a spider.
Yeah, yeah.
There's no chance for redemption. And several of these people are repentant. And actually what he does even brings other people to a point of acknowledging what they did. Not all of them, but like Emily Brent, the spinster who was completely unrepentant because of her rigid belief in God's law over turning away her servant girl who'd gotten pregnant because, well, that she wouldn't have done that if she was a God-fearing girl. And the girl drowns herself. And she's like, well, that's nothing to do with me.
Mm-hmm.
She shouldn't have gotten pregnant.
Right, right.
But by the time she dies, she's starting to kind of not feel bad, but I guess she's also had a drug, but she's suddenly thinking about her a lot. She's had it brought home to her a little bit more.
Yeah, and the General MacArthur.
Oh, he was very repentant. He was ready to die.
He was
tired of carrying that around.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's another one. Yeah,
but he lies to himself almost up to the end because he's like, well, I didn't really think of it as murder. I'm like, yes, you did. You knew what you were doing.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. And that final letter is riveting. It's so well written. And the play, by the way, ends with Wargrave gives his, you know, info dump speech you know, murderers usually give. And also importantly, in the play, Lombard and Vera turn out to be innocent of the murders that he's accusing them of, and they survive.
You know, and I saw that when I was kind of looking up because I knew there had been so many versions of this done for visual entertainment. And to me, that robs everything of its power.
It sure does. When now that I've read this, I can fully understand that. But the play is not as dark as the book is. It is more an entertainment. I mean, not that this isn't entertainment. It was extremely entertaining, but it's not as dark and probably not as meaningful. But you're right. Now that I know that this ending, that ending did rob some of the power out of the story.
Well, I know that Christy wrote the play, and the thing I saw said that she and the producers felt like no one's going to come and see something this dark. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to kind of fix it. And you can do that. I mean, most of her books have, you know, the happy ending for the people who aren't, you know, guilty. But this one, everybody's guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And so,
Yeah, interesting. And it's interesting that, you know, Agatha Christie wrote it, so she didn't feel so strongly, you know, she wrote the play is what I mean. She didn't feel so strongly that, you know, important to her, that the ending doesn't change. You know, you hear that kind of a story now and then, but that's not what happened there.
Yeah, I don't think she was busy making a huge moral statement. I think that's the statement that comes out of the book if you stop and think about it from our point of view, since we're reading it for more than just entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Because the other thing was, and I saw somebody mention this, and it might have been Jeff Miller, but in his little comment about the book, but something I never thought about, everyone in this book is unlikable.
Mm.
I mean, you don't care about the policeman and his sergeant at the end, but everyone in the book is unlikable. And this is a riveting book, and she does it by one of those little tricks of, because you see a lot into Vera's mind, and Philip Lombard is just an attractive adventurer type of a character, and that's what comes foremost.
Mm-hmm.
You relate to them a lot, and that's important because it has to carry you through to the end of the book. And when they're suddenly revealed for much more of who they are, you're down to two people, and you're just going, well, I want one of them to live at least, or can't they band together and get off, even though they're both clearly very guilty? You're still rooting for them, or I was usually. And you see that, you know what? No, they don't deserve it. They're both guilty. And I just thought that was such an accomplishment for you to not realize how unlikable they all were.
Right. Also, yeah, kind of think about that. I was just saying, you know, when you say that and I think about it, that's so true. I think that the most likable characters there are Vera and Philip. But at the same time, you know, it's like every now and then you watch a movie or read a story where the author tries to make some kind of a villain the protagonist of the story.
Yeah.
So you're actually rooting for someone to get the bank robbed, or you're rooting for someone to survive the mob that's chasing him, you know.
Right.
It's kind of the same type of a thing.
And think that this is written in 1939. Think how this book would have slashed upon everybody.
Uh-huh.
Nobody had done that kind of thing as much.
Right.
And it's so dramatic about it. Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of interesting, too, because I recently read a book called Now I Walk on Death Row.
Uh-huh.
And that's told by, it's a real-life testimonial story told by a former high-powered Wall Street lawyer who, over a period, I think it's probably 20 or 25 years that he's telling us about, kind of goes through this transformation himself internally to kind of ask, what if Jesus meant what he said? You know, what should I be doing?
Mm-hmm.
And he winds up as a death row spiritual advisor. He's Catholic. He'll go take communion to the people who are Catholic, but he has certain people, after he's done it for so long, he'll say, will you be my spiritual advisor? And he talks about both that internal transformation, and also he's giving testimony to everybody at the very end of the book about what death row was like and the death penalty. And he's putting it forth just in point of view of money spent versus money to keep them alive and all this. But tangentially, he'll kind of mention here and there, well, if you're Catholic and you're pro-life, which you're supposed to be, if the society has the resources to not kill people, to keep the wolves locked away from the sheep, basically, that's their duty.
Yeah.
And this book kind of made me it was interesting reading this one right after that, when I was like, oh, he summarily, the judge, takes away every chance they have.
Hmm.
Hello? Are you there?
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah,
my screen was thinking. Doing weird things. Okay. No. I wasn't sure.
Now, that's interesting. Now, I know Pope John Paul used to talk about the death penalty all the time. Is that Is that an official teaching of the Catholic Church?
No, it is. And I happen to know this because this is one of those things that when I came into the church, there were a few things where I was like, well, mental reservations on this one, mental reservations on that one. And it wasn't on any of this super important stuff, the Eucharist, the central things.
Right, right.
But it was a lot of the social teachings that now don't go along with what our society says is proper and correct and everything.
Sure, sure.
And as each thing kind of came up to me, I had to stop and kind of go, well, I at least need to do them the courtesy of looking into why they say it. Mm. And of course, that's the death blow to anything that I thought, because then I'd go, damn, 2,000 years of logic going right back to, oh, that commandment. Oh, that teaching of Christ. Oh, this hurts. I hate this. Okay, I've got to change my attitude on it.
Yeah.
And the death penalty I came up against when, because that was when I was like, you know what? No. Not. I always was like, those people have done something so heinous, they deserve to die. And then I wound up being in a jury pool for, right after 9/11, there was some guy who went into a 7-Eleven and killed a Sikh shop owner, you know?
Yeah.
And that was famous because he was like, they did it and I'm getting back our own. And everybody was like, oh man, no. Well, I wound up being in the jury pool for that guy. And he was not claiming innocence. He was saying he was guilty, but what they were looking for is a death penalty jury.
Hmm.
You know, do they kill him? Do they keep him alive? And it's funny because by that time I'd read just enough of what John Paul said to say nominally that I thought I was in agreement with him. I was like, yeah, that's wrong. But what happened is when I was one of the people picked who had to go back and just talk to the judge, the two lawyers, the guy who did it, and whoever else was sitting around. There were about eight people in the courtroom.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought us all in one by one and started taking us through these questions. And what happened was I was dismissed because they could really easily see, and I was brought face to face with, nominally, I was going, yeah, the church is right, you shouldn't do this. But underneath, I didn't believe it.
Mm-hmm.
Because they brought up people like Darlie Routier, who's a mother who killed her children for the insurance, or that's what she was convicted of. She's in prison. And they're like, so Darlie Routier, should she die? And I was like, yes, because she planned it. And they were like, okay, so, and they kind of laid it all out and went, this is what you think? And I was like, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
They went, okay, we don't need you. And I was like, oh my gosh. And I went back and struggled with that.
Oh, wow. Yeah. Yeah.
It was funny because nobody cared but me. But I was like, I'm saying one thing and believing another. So I really then had to dig in deep and really read this stuff and go, what's really true? And dang it again. I was like, oh, but it's a funny thing when you, for me anyway, the times when I've had to read back and go, what is it they're teaching and why? If I can find somebody logical enough, and it's usually Peter Kreeft or somebody like him, which is K-R-E-E-F-T, but I think it's pronounced Kreeft.
Mm-hmm.
He's the professor of philosophy, but he's written books about this kind of thing, and he presents it so logically. And I know the other side so well because that's what I was raised in, that I can see where my argument from the current social teachings just falls apart.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I kind of come at it from a slightly different point of view, I guess. I am against the death penalty because I would much rather make the mistake of not killing someone who is guilty of murder than of killing someone who is not guilty. So I feel like it's society's burden to go ahead and put these, like you said, separate the sheep from the wolves. But I think that there are enough cases that, you know, we've seen over the years of people who have been wrongly accused and found guilty. that I don't know that I could ever, I mean, it would have to be so positively correct, you know, for me to ever vote for someone to have the death penalty.
I mean, you're a nicer person than I am.
Oh, I don't know about that, but I'm just
saying. No, you are. You're more open-minded to that opportunity, and you'll give the bad guy the benefit of the doubt. And the funny thing to me is I will now, because once I said, okay, this hurts so much, I can't tell you to have to change this fundamental way I think. But once I started, went, okay, very gradually, I wound up embracing it. Mm-hmm. Because I knew the logic behind it, and I had to give up my emotional or whatever other wrong logic. And so now I'm like you, and that kind of, it's kind of what that book points out.
Mm-hmm.
Is not only are there people who were sincerely guilty, and there's one guy in the book, it's a very powerful moment when he says, okay, I've known you for a long time. Let me tell you, I've been in here 20 years. And he's like, and I did it. And he goes, and you know what? I thank God that I was put in jail so I don't have more on my conscience. And I thank God I was put here because this is where I found him. This is what he had to do for me to come to know him.
Wow.
He goes, so I don't regret being, I don't like being here. I would like to get out. I'm a different person now, but I don't, you know, I should be here.
Wow.
And so your attitude is really the right one, you know? Always well, err good. On the side of
yeah, but
the,
that's what I've always felt. You know, you just have a lot of stories about, oh, this guy was executed for this, and then they find out that, oh, he really didn't do that.
Yeah.
And that's something that I would have a hard time living with if I was a juror, and, you know, I was talked into saying yes, and turns out it was a no. That would just, that would be upsetting.
Well, and since then, like the guy in that book, I read the story of, I think he's beatified maybe, and I can't remember his name. Is it young saint who died at the age of like 12 or 13?
Mm-hmm.
Because he wanted to marry her, and she said no, and then he attacked her and raped her, and she died of her wounds, I think.
Huh.
But forgiving him on her deathbed. She's a famous Saint Maria Goretti.
Okay.
She's famous if you have a young daughter or no young girls, usually, because she's a saint of young women to preserve their chastity and their sanctity. But he wound up converting in prison, and he was actually present, I think, he was brought to the place where she was beatified. I think that's the guy, the right guy. And what that did was that story, which I read much later, to me was a powerful statement about the fact that if you're busy, even if there's no chance that they were innocent, you're taking away from them their chance for their soul to be redeemed.
Hmm.
I mean, you don't know what good they'll do for others, because it's either this guy or someone else, and I'll find the links, and so we can put them up there.
Okay.
Who wrote a powerful letter that, and maybe his letters were turned into a book, and later on the warden was one of the people who was going, no, he was a different person. And he testified that one day he was in his cell, and he was like, you know what? I give up. You're right. And it was like this grace infused his soul, and he was like, and I was set free. I was different. And then from that time on, he started becoming a huge blessing to everybody he was around in the prison and helping them. And so that's taking it a step further past the practical aspect that you're talking about, which is super important. But as a Catholic, you've got to look deeper and go, how can you deny them that chance?
Yeah.
They can take it or they can leave it, but you've got to give them as much of a chance as you can.
Mm-hmm.
As long as you're not, you know, in Africa, where you know the warlords are coming down, and if you catch one, there's no place to keep them, then that's a different matter.
Right, right.
You have to dispense a rougher justice to protect the people, because the people are always more important than that person. But if you can, and we're rich enough to do it, and we should.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's how I feel too.
Yeah.
And isn't it, you know, if you're talking about redemption, you know, in this book, it's interesting that, you know, you don't know what these people's lives were like, you know, specifically what their inner lives were like before all these events. But the stress of going through what they went through made him confront the their past.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of them. And that's an interesting thing. You know, what is it in our lives that makes us go ahead and go to confession finally? You know, it's certainly we don't all want to be on an island with nine other people.
No, please no.
But yet the same thing, there needs to be this shaking or sometimes, you know, I know in my life, you know, I've carried some things, you know, along for a long time before I realized, you know, I need to go get rid of this. Mm-hmm. Or I need to confess this. When it's almost like, you know, you're in denial that there was a sin there. And then I don't know what shakes you out of that. And you're thinking, you know, oh, that was what I just did there. That really wasn't right. You know, or what I did there, you know, 2 years ago or whatever. You know, have you ever had that? Or is that just me? Yeah. So, but I don't know what it is that, or what kind of an event shakes you and makes you realize, oh, wow, that was no good.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's a lot of times for me, and because in my regular life, I'm trying so much harder to be a good person, and so it's easier to recognize it when it happens. But a lot of times, and I hate to say this, this is my own sense of self-satisfaction, I suppose. I'll be going, oh, it's the quarter is up, and the guy, the priest who taught our RCIA said, you know, really, you should go once a quarter. That's enough to see the big things God's trying to show you about yourself. Mm-hmm. A lot of times I'm like, I'm a pretty good person. And I think I might've talked about this before. And so I'll have to start, and I hate this, because God's faithful. And I'll say, okay, what is getting in between you and me? What am I doing that's really offensive, that is holding me back? Mm-hmm. Oh man, the next week or so is murder.
Oh wow.
Because suddenly everything that could possibly like provoke a quick temper and a sharp response comes right at me. And do I hold out? No. I am being about as unpleasant as possible. And I, you know, luckily it usually just takes 2 or 3 days when I suddenly go, oh, I really think pretty much of myself, don't I? Look at how I am to these people. Okay, I get it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wish I could say it was just one thing usually, but
yeah.
Usually there's a lot of things connected, but I've also carried around stuff. That's what that retreat did. That was really big. That Christ Renews His Parish. And we all have different moments, I think, that we suddenly go, I think I'm hiding something from everyone, but God already saw me do it. The only one I'm hiding it from is me. And a lot of times the other people around you can see it really clearly. You're the only one who's hiding. And, you know, and that retreat had an opportunity for confession. And I had gone to confession a couple weeks before that and was like, I am clean as a whistle. The person who spoke right before that, it was like a huge light bulb went off. And I was like, this is why I'm here. Oh, my gosh. And I could hardly wait to go to confession. Went face to face, which I never do. This may also be a story I've told. I can't remember.
No, don't recall it.
I don't have that many big stories, so I have to tell them over and over, like an old grandma. But that was probably the most freeing experience I can recall, because I don't even hardly recall what the guy said, but people, it was like I was hearing God. It was like he was just speaking Jesus' words to me. Hmm. They were so understanding and loving and you know, not denying what I'd done, but also understanding why I was motivated, why I needed to hide that from myself and all the hurt I'd experienced, you know, all that kind of stuff. And I was like, wow, it was like a floating when I came out of there.
Yeah. Well, that's terrific. Yep.
And is that how you feel when you come out of confession?
Yeah, without question. You know, I remember at the beginning of this podcast, we talked about confession a little bit and how I was having trouble. But but since then, you know, I've gone and it was terrific. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I understand the value now, you know what I mean? It's so important.
Well, it's funny because, you know, the popular conception, of course, is you go around feeling guilty and dwelling on everything bad you did.
Mm-hmm.
But I like what you said is I've been carrying that with me.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you know, if somebody could take that feeling away from you, wouldn't you want to give it to them?
Sure. Yeah.
And of course they do.
Yeah. And it's a really good feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. It like allows you to move on. And I don't know any other way to describe it. You lay it at Jesus's feet and move on.
Yeah. And it's a real sacrament, meaning that it's real. It's not just, I've seen people say, oh, you don't need to go to a therapist if you go to confession, meaning to me that they're kind of equivalent. And in one sense, I suppose they are. But in the other sense, this is real, because what you get is you not only get absolution, like I understand and you understand. Now, go, don't do it anymore.
Right.
And of course, we try and we fail at some things and we do better at other things. But what it also gives you is actual grace to help you avoid it and recognize it in the future. And that's how we can move forward.
I think that's the piece that I didn't realize as much.
Yeah.
But it's true. It really does work that way. And, you know, if you're looking at it from outside the church and you see that as a therapeutic thing, I think that is, like, it's a valid way to look at it, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But there is this other aspect that I think people don't understand. And but it's really there.
Yeah. Well, that's the part that's hard to grasp unless you've gone through it. And I think you have to have a powerful experience such as you've had and I've had. And probably everybody who's ever gone to confession, there's usually some big thing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And, a lot of times, think of all the family stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, think of the murders that were done here. Some were for gain. Some were for carelessness, like Anthony Marsden. But a lot of them were from family problems, jealousy, not understanding love, that kind of thing.
Yep, yep.
That was Vera.
Right.
The jealousy was the general.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that most regular people, that's what affects them more than anything.
Yeah.
And everybody can relate to that.
Yeah, sure enough. And what did you think about the judge's mark of Cain? He's like, I am so awesome that I'm going to go ahead and put this mark of Cain on myself.
No God complex, right?
None at all. Yeah.
That's an excellent point. I had not thought of that connection. Mm-hmm. I just went, oh, East of Eden, here we are again, right? Back to Genesis one more time.
One more time.
But you're right. I hadn't. Wow. Because God puts the mark of Cain on you. You don't put it on yourself.
Right.
Well, he is quite the fellow, isn't he?
He is quite the fellow.
Yeah. And that's why he couldn't leave without having somebody have the chance to recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about the sin of pride.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is the most basic sin.
Right.
That all others spring from.
Yep.
So the church teaches. I'll just say that so people don't think I'm saying that on my own.
Right.
I'm continually looking at more examples of that going, wow, they were right again. Still right. Wow.
No.
I know. Thank you for pointing out how I share in that so much. Oh. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, that's the thing.
It is. It really is.
The one other thing talking about confession, and we've probably talked about this before, is the fact that all those people, only one person, when the list of charges are read out, says, yeah, I did it.
Mm-hmm. Everybody else is like, no.
Busy hiding.
You misunderstand.
Himself. Yeah.
You don't understand. This is what really happened.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And everyone's like, oh, I know, because they're thinking, I've got something like that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's very, very, and it's all that pride thing and justification. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so, well, didn't mean to go to confession again, people, but Catholic, what are you going to do?
That's what happens, yeah.
Yeah.
Terrific book. So thanks for picking that. I loved it. I really loved it.
Yeah, you liked it. I didn't realize you hadn't read it when I picked it, so.
No, I hadn't read it. I was just in the play and,
yeah.
Different things, yeah. It's funny, when I was reading it, there was, some of the lines were the same. It's been years, so, I'd come across this Wargrave line. I was like, oh, I remember saying that. It's funny. It's still in there somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I loved it. Loved reading it.
Oh, one last thing just about the book, and I guess the attitude of the people at the society at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, did it strike you the way it struck me about, here's Mr. Rogers, who has just found his wife dead. She won't wake up. And they're all milling around going, well, breakfast is awfully late this morning. And the doctor goes, well, you've got to be easy on him because, you know, we just found his wife dead. His wife's dead. And no one says, oh, poor fellow. Let's let him sit. I'll get breakfast. They're all like, well, that's very understandable then. And he's serving breakfast and he's got his face downcast. They're like, oh, we're terribly sorry to hear. And he goes, thank you. Thank you very much. And he's back out there washing the dishes, you know, and I'm like, oh, OMG.
I'm so depressed. Yeah. And he, when he served a cold lunch or something, cold tongue and ham or something like that.
Right.
And they were all, you know, well, this isn't the best, but all right.
Well, she was a great cook, wasn't she? They all go, wow, she was an excellent cook. Well, that's all right. We understand. He's like, thank you. This was the best I could do. Well, that's okay. We get it. She's dead. Because like, I mean, when he's killed, it's the next morning and he's up chopping firewood. That's right. Like, well, hopefully he didn't get us up the way he should have.
That is funny. Going, yep.
Well, the servants, they have no feelings. Uh-huh. Let's keep going. I was like, oh, okay, there's something wrong with society at that point.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, that's hilarious.
Oh, gracious. Yeah, just extend that, and that's the 20 African servants or whoever they were who Lombard abandoned. Because they don't really feel it the way everybody else does. Oh, gracious.
Oh, funny, funny, funny.
So.
Yes. All right. Let's see. So what's next? Contact.
Movie. Yeah, that's right.
Couple of weeks.
Right, because you'd sent me the audio file connection for Declare. So I was thinking of a book, but yes, Contact.
Yeah, and Contact is next. So you got 4 weeks to get through Declare.
Yeah, thank goodness. Because it's 3 7-hour episodes.
Wow. So 20 hours long or so.
21 hours. Well, Harry Potter, I'm going to have to set you to one spot.
Hello, Potter.
Probably that's just right. As well, because I finished listening to book 4, The Goblet of Fire, and I was like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize they got into the heavy stuff that fast. And I listening is such a more powerful experience than reading in some cases, as we've discussed. And I dreamed about it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. There's a lot of horrific stuff that happens.
There is. It's tough.
Of fire. And when you're hearing Jim Dale voice at all, I was like horrified.
Yeah.
And of course, riveted. So
Right.
I'll just give a plug to that because everybody, I'm just warning you, sometime next year, which is, I guess, our next season, we will be discussing the series.
Fantastic. Good deal. Good deal.
But I've heard good things about Contact and bad things, so I guess it just depends. I know you've always loved it. So.
Yeah, I've always loved it. And we'll talk about it more at the time. Yeah. But yeah, it's going to be good and bad, I think.
Yep.
So, but lots to talk about it.
Yep.
And then Declare by Tim Powers, we just mentioned that.
Yep.
And then it's October.
Ooh.
Oh, this is going to be a fun. This is
Shaun
fun.
Of the Dead.
Shaun of the Dead. Fantastic.
We haven't had enough zombies.
Not enough zombies.
Right? Mm-hmm. And then there were none. I'm looking at the Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury.
By Ray Bradbury. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Fantastic.
Another classic that people may have seen a movie, but might not have read the book.
Right.
Yeah.
And then in November, we're going to talk about The Social Network.
That's right.
Which is a movie I'm eager to talk about. Lots to talk about it.
Yeah, because you just watched that.
Yeah, again, there's going to be good and bad in there. And then I haven't selected the book for November yet, so I've got some candidates and I'm thinking about it. So.
You have plenty of time also.
You bet. So I'll get that picked.
Oh, yeah, The Social Network. That's good because you were saying there weren't any Thanksgiving movies. And I'm like, and that is all about connecting and friends.
Yeah,
and
I guess it is.
Close or alienated. So. Uh-huh. Wow, you couldn't have picked better considering family that? And Thanksgiving.
How about
well
that?
Done.
All right. Why, thank you.
Yes.
Excellent. All right.
Yeah, so.
Well, see you in a couple weeks, everybody.
Yes.
I hope
it's been
you
fun.
Enjoyed Agatha Christie's And Then There Were None, because I did.
Yes, and I'll put, I'll try to remember to put links to a couple more of her really famous books.
Oh, good. Okay.
Yeah. That are definitely worth reading.
Excellent. Okay. So, fantastic. Okay. All right. Well, we'll see you all later. Thanks for listening.
Yeah. Thanks, everybody. Bye.
Bye-bye.